Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning. 6:06 on the 22nd. It's going to be another roaster, of course, and have a lot of stuff on the plate for us. Many topics, but I am feeling a little bit better. I may not sound like it, but trying to work my way through this cold. All right. So it is a fact that the Democrats were devastated by the loss of John Ossoff, even though he looked like a chihuahua that was trained to speak like President Obama. He still had tens of millions of dollars in his pocket and he misused it. Who is the architect of these failures? Is it Nancy Pelosi? I think it's very close to time for her to leave. Number one, she's been in leadership a long time. Number two, she was spectacularly defiant during the healthcare when Obamacare was passed and put in, and then as her party began to lose a major number of House members and Senate members, she was defiant. She's still defiant. She's never made a mistake. And she's also very old, and so her mind kind of fails her at times. So here's a little bit on Nancy Pelosi, who I think within the next few months is bound to be replaced by someone who's a little bit younger and also not a fanatic, not an absolute, a wide-eyed fanatic who believes that every one of her ideas is true, which is the real problem in the Democratic Party. They've gone from a party of ideas and representation to some sort of a strange religious cult. But here's more on Nancy Pelosi.
Trump. Now some are blaming House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. My next guest has some harsh words for his own party. So joining me now is Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio. Congressman, I'm so glad you're here. So let's just be honest. You have tough love for your party. Democrats have won, what, 0 of 4 special elections for House seats? And here I want to show what you say and then get your response here. You said, I don't believe in moral victories. The only measure of success in political campaigns is victory. I don't believe everyone should get a trophy. Here's the truth. The Democratic Party has a toxic brand, one that is worse than Donald Trump's in many parts of the country. Explain, sir.
Well, it happens to be true. I mean, we all have a lot of anger towards what Donald Trump is doing, but we've had four special elections and Donald Trump 4, Democrats 0. And I hate to admit that. It hurts. It's painful. But we've got to get our act together because there's a lot of people relying on us. And I worry sometimes that we get so obsessed and angered by Donald Trump, which is okay, but you can't hold on to it because it takes your eye off the ball. And we're not focusing on the economic. In Ohio, Don, aren't really talking about Russia or Michael Flynn or Putin or anything else. They're worried about paying the bills, what's happening with our pension, how much does it cost to send a kid to school, what's our energy bill, like real bread and butter stuff. And when we're talking about Trump so much, we're not talking about them.
So how do you then reconcile the 36% approval rating and still winning the special elections?
Well, you know, everything's in contrast to who you're running against. And that's why I say I don't think people in the Beltway are realizing just how toxic the Democratic Party brand is in so many of the countries. This is a party that many of us grew up hearing. This is the party for the working class. And we've gotten away from that economic message about how do we help working class people, white, black, brown, gay, straight, people who work for a living, people who take a shower after work. That used to be the bread and butter, the backbone of the Democratic Party. And we're losing those people in droves. And when you see us losing them in these special elections,
how did you lose them?
Well, the brand's just bad. I mean, you know, you look at a guy like Ossoff, the kids, I thought he was a terrific candidate. The energy on the ground in our party is amazing. The resist movement, the indivisible groups, the swing left, all of these other groups, they're doing a terrific job, but they're not only fighting the Republican candidates, they're also fighting the Democratic brand. And that's a tough thing to overcome for a lot of candidates.
So then they went after Nancy Pelosi. Is Nancy Pelosi, does she sum up the Democratic brand?
Well, I think in some sense, yeah. I mean, she does. Clearly, we're coming off an election, and she's been getting pounded now for 10 years with negative ads from the Republicans. I don't think it's fair, but clearly these ads using her, linking her to our candidates, is still working. I mean, I wish it wasn't true.
You think Nancy Pelosi is more toxic than Donald Trump?
You know what? The honest answer is, in some areas of the country, yes, she is. That's the honest answer.
Why so?
I just think, first, as unfair as it is, there have been a lot of people that have spent a lot of money running negative ads against her. And I think that in certain areas, like in some of these special election districts, it doesn't benefit our candidates to be tied to her. And it's not fair, but it is true. And there's a reason why the Republicans are still using it. And when you hear Republicans talk in the gym or running around the House floor, they say, you know, just keep going the way you're going because we're still using this. I had a member of Congress grab me tonight, say, please tell me you're not going to get rid of Nancy Pelosi. Please tell me she's not going to retire because that's who I run against. She's less popular than Donald Trump in my district.
Let me ask you, you tried to unseat Nancy Pelosi as House Minority Leader in the aftermath of the 2016 election. You believe that it was time for new leadership then and now. Some of your colleagues, like New York Representative Kathleen Rice, are telling CNN it's time for Pelosi to go. Mm-hmm. Is Pelosi hurting Democrats' chances, flat out, chances of winning House races?
Well, it's 18 months out, but I think it does inhibit our ability in certain seats. I mean, you know, we've got to face that fact. And I'm not here crying sour grapes because I ran and lost. It's not about me. It's not about Nancy Pelosi. It's about that we have Donald Trump as president now. We've done something terribly wrong to make that so. And we've lost traditional Democratic voters. See us as connecting to them. Don't see us as advocates for them. And we've got to put ourselves in the best position possible to be able, you know, to win these races. As I said, you opened it up. Look, I don't think everybody should get a trophy in life. You get trophies because you earn them. I don't like second place. I don't like moral victories. That's not why I'm in politics. I believe in the ideas of the Democratic Party. I believe in a government that could be both nimble but yet active and support social justice issues that are critically important when you listen to what Trump talked about tonight. But the economic message, Don, is something that we've got to get back to. There's so many families that are struggling, and we're kind of not focused on that as much as we should.
Okay, let me ask you something then. Where were you guys and you, voices like yours, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, when Republicans and Trump surrogates were saying the exact same, much of what you're saying now about the Democratic Party? Why didn't you guys stand up then and say something?
Well, clearly we were standing up. It was in the middle of a presidential election, as you remember, and some of that message just didn't get through. I think we got too distracted. I think there are too many consultants telling too many candidates that you talk to black people about voting rights, you talk to brown people about immigration, you talk to, you know, LGBTQ people about, you know, those issues that affect them directly. And, you know, we lost the general message, economic message, in which it would help all of those people. Gay people want a job. Black people, brown people, they want a job. But if we just talk to them like we're talking to a slice of the electorate, we're doing them a very big disservice. And I think traditionally that's been the Democratic mode in the last 2 years.
Suggesting, though, not reaching out to those groups. And
no, I'm all for it. I'm a huge advocate for voting rights. I'm a huge advocate for immigration reform. I'm a huge advocate for the LGBTQ community. I was at the gay pride rally that was in Washington, D.C. with my wife and my three-year-old son a week or two ago. I'm for these issues right down the line. I'm a progressive. But if you don't have a strong economy and you don't have a message that's about opportunity for working class people, about putting people to work now, today, not training them for some job that may come on the if come, but how we create an economy that's really going to work for these people. How do we get investment into places like Youngstown, Ohio, so we can create jobs? And you know what? That means having a tax code that's simplified and that can help small businesses grow. That's the kind of Democratic Party we need to start being like again. And again, all of those interest groups fit underneath them. And that's important for
and
us
they're,
to
they're
talk
gonna,
about.
They're all the groups who you mentioned, for your words, they're going to have to understand that you have to reach out to other people and that you may not be able to reach out to them as much. Or you're saying you can do it all at the same time?
There's great synergy in a campaign that pulls all of those groups together. And what should pull all of these groups together, you know, working class people, Planned Parenthood, NARAL, LGBTQ, the Human Rights Campaign, all of these different groups can come together because you know why? If Democrats are in office, we are going to create opportunity and protections for
all of
those people. If we're
sounds likely. Take a little break here. Pelosi's toast. We're going to come back for a little Hall of Fame performance by Pelosi. 523-1450 AM Las Cruces. If you're a Democrat, feel free to call in. Please call in 523-1450 and let us know what your thoughts are on your party, what your plans are. Are you planning on bailing or are you stuck? And what you think the answer is to the problems of the Democratic Party, 523-1450 on AM Las Cruces, Kelly O'Connell. And we'll be right back. All right, so Nancy theologian. Nancy Pelosi is has got so many great, so many genius moments, but here's just one or two of them.
we're very, you've heard about the controversies within the bill, the process about the bill, one of the items. But I don't know if you have heard that it is a legislation for the future, not just about health care for America, but about a healthier America, where preventive care is not something that you have to pay a deductible for or out of pocket, that prevention is about diet, not diabetes. It's going to be very, very exciting. But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it away from the fog of the controversy.
That's reassuring, huh? You have to pass the bill to find out what's in it. And so what does it take to get to health care reform?
We must pass health care reform. The problem is still there. The financial aspects of it, the cost to individuals, to their families, to small businesses, to big business, to all business, to our deficits, to our federal budget, and to our economy are huge. We cannot sustain financially the current system. We, as I say, families, businesses, or the federal government. So this has to take place. The fact is also that as long as people are discriminated against because they have a pre-existing condition, or their policies are canceled because they get sick, or their procedure is denied on the way to the operating room with rescissions, as long as people go bankrupt if they have a diagnosis, we must pass this legislation. And we must take whatever time it takes to do it. Some things we can do on the side which may not fit into a bigger plan. That doesn't mean that's a substitute for doing comprehensive. It means we will move on many fronts, any front we can. As I said to some friends yesterday in the press, we go through the gate's closed, we'll go over the fence is too high, we'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in, but we're going to get health care reform passed for the American people, for their own personal health and economic security, and for the important role that it'll play in reducing the deficit.
So how do you like how do you like it now? Do they passed health care reform? How did they do? Now, Nancy Pelosi refers to late-term abortions as sacred ground. Check this out. What's your favorite word? What's the greatest word, Nancy Pelosi? You think about this, by the way. Can you imagine? Can you imagine Jesus taking part in an abortion?
All the time. What is your favorite this? What is your favorite that? What's your favorite that? And at one time, what is your favorite word? And I said, my favorite word, that is really easy. My favorite word is the word. Is the word. And that is everything. It says it all for us. And you know the biblical reference. You know the gospel reference of the word. And that word is, we have to give voice to what that means in terms of public policy that would be in keeping with the values of the word. The word. Isn't it a beautiful word when you think of it? Just covers everything. Word. fill it in with anything you want, but of course we know.
How about filling it in with stupidity and selfishness and abortion and forcing legislation on people who don't want it, and filling it in with attacks on other people like Trump?
It means the word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And that's the great mystery, other of our faith. He will come again. He will come again. So we have to make sure we're prepared to answer in this life or otherwise as to how we have measured up.
All right, so do you Catholics out there believe that Nancy has been a good Catholic? Term abortions are sacred ground. Economic vitality comes after abortions. What do you think about that? She's also got a lot of other thoughts, but just a time for a few more.
the comments made by my Republican colleagues are outrageous. Beneath the dignity of the job that they hold, beneath the dignity of the respect that we would like Congress to command, how dare they say such a thing? How dare they? I don't even go into the whole thing. I can't even begin. Probably as we sit here, they're running caricatures of me and Georgia once again for over $100 million of vitriolic things that they
say. This is about the shooting, by the way.
Say that resulted in calls to my home constantly, threats in front of my grandchildren, really predicated on their comments and their paid ads. So this sick individual does something despicable, and it was horrible what he did, hateful. But for them to all of a sudden be sanctimonious as if they don't never seen such a thing before. And I don't even want to go into the president of the United States, but in terms of some of the language that he has used. So again, let's go there another day. But since you asked, how could they possibly say such a thing? First of all, the timing of it all. Everybody is so sad, so concerned, so coming together. Let us all take a step back, examine our own conscience, see what negative attitudes we can all curtail. But the sanctimony of it all, really.
How about a negative attitude that the government can solve all problems? Isn't that a negative attitude that we need to take on? Here, this clip reminds me of Nancy. She reminds me of Flipper, the way she kind of hiccups up a lot of her words. All right, so here, time to step down. Check it out.
Hey, glad you're here.
I just want to ask you one thing. Nancy Pelosi has repeatedly referred to her faith, and she has repeatedly said the reason that she does her policy is because of Jesus, is because of religion, because of her Catholic faith or whatever. I want to ask you, why don't people rise up and attack her for this combining of church and state, huh? Well, it could be time to move down, to two-step down, Nancy.
The resistance resists the urge to fire Nancy Pelosi. Last night's stinging defeats in Georgia and South Carolina have some Democrats calling for Pelosi to retire and give the party a fresh face. Texas Congressman Philemon Vela did not mince words in the aftermath of the losses, saying, quote, "I think you'd have to be an idiot to think we could win the House with Pelosi at the top." Joining me now to offer some insight is Democratic strategist Richard Fowler. He's also a Fox News contributor. Welcome back, Richard.
Hey, Kennedy, how are you?
So,
you're live.
I know. Isn't that exciting? Look
is.
At us, just snuggling digitally. So I have always thought that Nancy Pelosi is a big fraud and she's a troublemaker. Now there are people on the left saying that she should hang up her Jimmy Choos. What do you think?
Well, I think you have to take a broader look at the Georgia 6th, right, before you can make that determination. Here's what we know. The Georgia 6th has been in Republican hands since 1979.
Excuses are not going to help Nancy Pelosi. No reason to listen to the end of this. Nancy Pelosi is done. The question is, how do they get rid of her? But she's done terrible harm. Think about the massive harm inflicted on your party. Those of you who are listening, who are Democrats, massive harm created by the so-called health care fix, Obamacare, which is now getting torn to shreds and is, if you can believe it, the only achievement by Barack Obama that he was willing to brag about. We'll take a break. 6:31, we have local news, 523-1450. Feel free to call in, friends. Vent your spleen. I have a lot of sympathy for you if you're a Democrat and you're disappointed in crazy Nancy. There's always room, by the way, under the big tent of the GOP. All right, my computer's stuck. We'll be right back. All right, so we have devastation because of John Ossoff. Check this out. Check it out. Rush Limbaugh, Democrats devastated over Karen Hondell win over John Ossoff.
Devastated today. I cannot describe it to you. The media and the Democrat Party are destroyed today. Complete and utter defeat, frustration, devastation, and they have no answers. Greetings, Rush Limbaugh here. Great to have you. Telephone number 800-282-2882. The email address, lrushbaugh@eibnet.com. All they've got is chasing a bunch of Russian ghosts. They are continuing to chase ghosts. They cannot win elections. I know many of you got tired of me pointing out the fact that the Democrats continue to lose elections. Because you said to me, Russia doesn't matter. They're still winning. That's because the media is not on the ballot. The media is running the left wing now, not the Democrats. But the Democrats not being able to win elections means the media has no way of implementing or exercising electoral power. The Democrats' electoral power has never been this low since the 1920s. A New York Times headline, Democrats seethe after Georgia. Quote, our brand is worse than Trump. A prominent Democrat consultant. They are just devastated today. I cannot describe it to you. You're going to have to take my word for it. Just like I asked you to take my word for it back on June the 9th, the pajama boy, Ossoff, is up 49.47 and a half over the Republican candidate, and it's getting close. So you have people that live there who are sending me notes that are in panic. They've never seen an election in their district this intense, with this many spots on TV, and with this much hatred being bandied about. You can see in the emails, you can read it, they're scared to death.
All right, so the sound quality on that is not great. But here's the question. We got Ben Rossen coming up in a few minutes. But what is wrong with the Democratic Party, and what can they do to fix it? 5-2-3-14-50. I've got my thoughts. I'm sure you have yours. If you're a Democrat, I'm especially interested in what your opinion is. But what does the Democratic Party stand for? The Democratic Party stands for feminism, right? And women's rights and gay rights. And especially racial politics, identity politics. What else does it stand for? Does it stand for capitalism? No. Does it stand for secure borders? No. Does it stand for strong foreign policy? Not that I can tell. Does it stand for taking a firm front in liquidating ISIS? Maybe. I don't know. I haven't really heard a lot of people talk about that who are in the Democratic Party. I do think that because of the views of the Democrats on religion, it's more important to treat all religions equally and not be biased against Muslims than anything else. Now, what attitude does the Democratic Party and liberalism have towards religion in general? Indifference, right? Disbelief, scorn, laughter. Frankie is a typical example of somebody that is completely dismissive of religion and thinks it's an absolute joke, but would supposedly die to defend the dignity of Muslims because we have to treat religions all the same. You see what I'm getting at? There's 1,000 contradictions in the Democratic Party. So is the Democratic Party just going to implode pieces and nothing left, or are they going to fix themselves in some manner and come forward? Now, I don't know. I mean, the theory is that every party wants to survive and thrive, but I haven't seen it yet from the Democrats. Telling people that Trump is a Hitler and saying we need to get him out of office and then having elections based on resist is not working out. The question is, are they going to stay with it? When, why is it that Democrats or the liberals, some people in the Democratic Party are not real super liberals, but why are these people who are leading the party, why do they act like every position of the Democratic Party comes off Mount Sinai is a religious piece of religious revelation? and has to be defended to the end of the earth. Why? I mean, is this working out for the Democrats? 523-1450. We'll be right back. I've, by the way, got a little bit of weather for you nationally, and there's a storm that is impacting Texas.
Storm Cindy has made landfall 4 o'clock local time in southwestern Louisiana. You can already see the flooding in Cameron, Louisiana. Well, this is going to continue right through the end of the week. Even though this storm has now made landfall, it's not over yet. We still have a lot of rain and the potential for some severe weather. So here we go with the forecast. Now, it has made landfall. This is going to continue to take a northeasterly turn. Winds right now are 40 miles per hour. Important to note, tropical storm warnings stay in effect all along the Gulf Coast. So central Gulf Coast, you're still very much in the middle of this. Here's a look at a little bit of the history. Now, we did have a lot of spin-ups with this storm yesterday. Today, we'll likely see more of that. Locally, we've already seen 10-plus inches of rain. So flooding is going to be a big concern, especially for the right side of this storm. So notice the arc, Shreveport, Memphis, all the way up into Nashville. So for the Tennessee Valley, really, you're going to start to get in on some of the heavier rain from today right through the end of the week. Through tonight, there's a look at your severe weather threat. We could see some spin-ups once again through parts of Louisiana all the way up through Jackson, Mississippi. Here's what it will look like on the radar. So rain through much of the day on Thursday. This is going to extend into Friday as well. And there's a look at the rainfall forecast and what's still to come. Heaviest rain is going to push from Houston all the way into the Tennessee Valley. Nashville, you could get 5 inches of additional rainfall right into the weekend.
All right, so that's your storm, and here's your local weather. All right, so the Democratic Party is in a shambles in America. It's in a shambles in Illinois, especially because Illinois is going broke. So what happened to Illinois? I've got a little clip here from Illinois Policy, published about a month ago.
Why Illinois is dead broke. Illinois has a fairness problem, and it's crushing families across the state. It starts with the state budget. Every year since 2002, Illinois state government has spent more money than it's taken in. Without enough cash to pay the bills, Illinois can't take care of high-need residents who depend on services from the state to get by. Bad budgets hurt working Illinoisans too, because their employers either rely on state payments to keep the doors open, or they're afraid the cost of doing business in Illinois will keep going up. How could this be? What causes these unfair budgets that overspend by billions? A single concept explains it all: political power. The people who pay for government aren't the priority. Neither are the poor and disadvantaged. In Illinois, special interests get a seat at the bargaining table with politicians on both sides of the aisle. These interests include state worker unions, local government officials, and other groups that make their living on government spending. Every year, politicians make big promises to these groups, such as guaranteed raises, extra job security, and funding with no strings attached. In return, politicians get votes, campaign cash, and other electoral support. Lawmakers who dare to go against the system are threatened with losing their political power. So how does that system of political power affect budget fairness? Just look at the state's spending priorities over the last 15 years. Pensions and state employee health insurance costs are growing at an incredible rate, while other programs suffer. Every year, when faced with tough budget decisions, Illinois politicians promise the world the special interests, kick the can down the road on spending, and eventually ask taxpayers to pony up. This system doesn't work. Today, Illinois state government is spending at record levels, but needy residents still see service cuts, and the state has the worst credit rating in the nation. Meanwhile, Illinoisans in the private sector see the worst jobs growth in the Midwest and the nation's highest property taxes, but they're being asked to pay even more. Fixing Illinois' budget problem means fixing the state's fairness problem. Here are 5 ways lawmakers must change their mentality.
Well, you get the idea. And I mean, the part of it is tax and spend But this is the place that Obama came from. What did he do to help Illinois? He was in the state Senate. He was in the U.S. Senate from Illinois. Is it Obama's fault? No. The fault is corruption, endemic corruption that has gone on for years and has never been addressed. And so, you know, you've got the worst city in America, which is Chicago. You've got the worst state in America, which is Illinois. The worst city for safety is Chicago. The worst state for fiscal soundness is not New Mexico. It's Illinois, and it's not even close. And they want to declare bankruptcy. Let's take our last break here, and we'll be right back. Continuing on, what can we learn from Illinois? But how about Illinois as a way to wipe out the Democratic Party in Illinois? The problem in Illinois is socialism. Socialism is fostered by the Democratic Party. What's the answer? Dick Morris.
Margaret Thatcher said it best. She said that socialism doesn't work because eventually you run out of other people's money. Well, that's what's happening in Illinois today. And it gives us a tremendous opportunity to undercut the entire financial base of the Democratic Party and much of its voter base. Illinois is going broke, as Detroit did before it, as Greece has, as all of these socialist countries have. And many other states are about to follow. Puerto Rico's far down the road, Connecticut and a bunch of other states may find themselves in the same situation. But the controller in Illinois says we're flat broke. The governor says that it's becoming a newly elected Republican, says it's becoming a banana republic. And they have $13 billion in unpaid bills and $130 billion in unfunded pension liability. Well, the solution to it, the only solution to it, is emerging as declaring Chapter 7 a bankruptcy for the state. Politics comes in. There's no provision of law now that permits a state to go bankrupt. So Congress would have to pass that. And the state is likely to go to Congress and beg them to give them the opportunity to go bankrupt and be protected by the bankruptcy laws. I believe that at that point, the leadership of Congress, the Republicans, should come back to Illinois and say, we set up two conditions. One of which is fairly standard in these situations, a review board, a control board that controls taxes and spending in the state until it no longer needs bankruptcy protection. That's being done in Detroit and Puerto Rico and a bunch of other places. But the second condition is the main one. We should require that Illinois eliminate and divest itself of all municipal union contracts, so that they all terminate. And if the union is unwilling to terminate them, well, they can't get any of the revenues that are flowing from under this agreement. There has to be an agreement to end these union contracts and then renegotiate them on a basis where they're sustainable, where they don't contribute massive amounts to a pension liability, and where essentially Illinois can function or conceivably have no union agreements at all. Just pay your employees like used to happen. The Illinois cannot be permitted to avoid reckoning with its own fate that it made for itself, its own bed that it made, unless the things that landed it in bankruptcy are alleviated or attenuated. And the political effect of this would be devastating on the Democratic Party. They would lose their major source of funding, their major source of workers and voters, and much the same transformation that's taken place, for example, in Wisconsin, where the teachers union was knocked out of play by a very similar agreement, could operate in Illinois. So hang on to that idea. It's an idea, actually, that I've had for 5 or 6 years, but I've been waiting for a chance.
All right. So what do you think of the idea, and how have unions helped or harmed New Mexico? All right, I have a little bit of Jim Gaffigan, animal lover.
We love steak, but it is rather barbaric, right? I mean, we're eating a part of a cow, and I love animals, and I love animal lovers, My favorite are the people that carry around the dog in a bag. Whenever I see that, I always think, what an adorable way to let us know you're crazy. Because they're crazy. They're carrying around an animal that can walk in a bag. They're not going to the vet. They're shopping. That's okay, but if I carry around a canned ham, I'm a weirdo. It'd be one thing if the dog looked happy, but the dog always has a look on his face like, can you believe I'm sitting in a purse? I was part of Mexican royalty. But I get it. I love dogs, and I think it's cute when people dress their dogs up. But how do you have your dog in a jacket and walk by a homeless person? Sorry, I'd help, but I spent all my money on a coat for my animal that's born with a coat. I love cats. Some people don't like cats. Our neighbor has a cat, and she lives in the studio apartment, or as I refer to it, a litter box. One time she asked me, she was like, can you even tell I have a cat? I was like, no, but I can tell you have a box of turds in your apartment. I'm not sure if that's the same question. We all have the friend with the cat, right? In the small place, you visit them, the cat does their business. You don't really acknowledge it. You just go on with the conversation. What do you want on your pizza? Bleach. Febreze. Can we open a window or knock down a wall? Are my eyes bleeding? How about we throw a diaper on the kitty? But I get it because I love animals. I think being around animals, there's a healing quality. But I also think we give animals too much credit. Like a dog is man's best friend. I've never seen a dog help someone move. Yes, horses are graceful and elegant until you see them poop standing up. Dolphins are smart. Learn English like Jesus did.
All right, so I want to talk after Ben leaves, get into this question again of how we can fix our economy. What we talked about this yesterday, and this town in Tennessee realized it was sitting on a gold mine. It had this giant lake that was full of fish, and so they started putting together fishing tournaments, and each one brings in $500,000, whatever. What if we had something like that? Well, we do have stuff like that. Was it Jason who called in and said rock crawling? We could put rock crawling events. Of course, the environmentalists will fall crying on the ground. Oh my God, you're destroying the environment. So, but there's always a cost. Everything has a cost. There's upside, downside. The cost to not having an economy, though, is all the kids grow up and leave, or they either don't have a very good job, or they go to NMSU and leave to some city that has a functional economy. While the city leaders are sitting there yucking it up, we have an outgrowth economy. We're living in paradise. Something wrong with this picture, folks. We'll take you out here with James Booker's Pop's Dilemma. 523-1450. We'll be back at the next hour with Ben Ross. And meanwhile, 659 on the button. And Pop's Dilemma. And so Ben is running a few minutes late, but I have an interest in what's going on with this ship that was run into the American military vessel. I think it was a it was a missile ship. The story doesn't add up. I don't know exactly what happened, but there's something that is there, or a lot of stuff they're not telling us. Check this out.
New developments in that deadly collision between the USS Fitzgerald and a massive cargo ship.
Multiple maritime trackers show the ACX Crystal cargo ship making that giant U-turn just 25 minutes before colliding with the USS Fitzgerald.
The Navy says the collision happened in clear weather at 2:20 a.m. Saturday, but Japan's Coast Guard says the accident took place an hour earlier.
Nautical miles south of Tokyo, which was supposed to be the Crystal's destination. But according to marinetraffic.com, the cargo ship made a U-turn shortly before the crash and was headed in the opposite direction.
This marine tracker shows the cargo ship making a hard turn at 1:30 a.m. and a U-turn, backtracking at 2:20 a.m.
All right, so there's something, the thing that caught my attention, one of the things, was that they didn't know what time it happened at, or they knew what time it happened, but Japan changed it, or the other ship changed it. Doesn't make any sense. Here's a little bit from AMTV on this.
Hey, everybody, welcome to AMTV, Alternative Media Television. My name is Chad Booksham. What really happened to the USS Fitzgerald?
The search for answers after a deadly collision at sea between a U.S. Navy destroyer and a cargo ship that killed seven Navy sailors.
Now, this is what we're getting from reports. Over the Father's Day weekend, a cargo ship supposedly collided with the USS Fitzgerald early in the morning when it was still dark, and seven Navy sailors died. And they died because a gash in the bottom of the Navy vessel let in so much water, the ship was about to sink, and they had to close the hatch or the whole ship would have went down. And that cost the lives of seven Navy sailors, which alone is just a disaster, a catastrophe, and very sad given the situation. Now, there's a lot of confusion surrounding this collision because the misinformation is coming from the sources, the U.S. military and Japanese officials. First of all, they were off on the time. They first said it happened at 2:30. Right. And then they changed it to 1:30. The Japanese officials did. And then the U.S. military was like, no, it happened at 2:30. And then after they went behind scenes and behind closed doors, they all agreed to 1:30. So that alone makes it smell fishy. OK, that alone makes it smell fishy. Also, on top of that, the Japanese company who charters the ACX Crystal, that's the name of the cargo ship, will not tell us where the destination of the cargo ship was going, will not tell us the original destination of the cargo ship. Why? Now, what we've heard from reports is all of the personnel on the cargo ship were Filipino, all Filipino. And right now they are docked in Tokyo, but they have not released the original destination of the cargo ship. Now, another point, we see from maritime reports, not from really media reports, but anybody can log on to these maritime locations where shipping or where shipping routes are, where ships are, and you can see their location. And what's been pinpointed by just regular citizens around the world is that the ACX Crystal did a sharp right turn right before the collision against the USS Fitzgerald, meaning it was targeting it, meaning it was targeting it. Now, if that didn't happen, let's take a look. First of all, the USS Navy vessel has awesome high-tech technology, radar systems, military radar systems, missile defense systems, can detect a freaking fish flapping in the water. This cargo ship's not that small. It's pretty big, actually. Nowhere near big, the Navy vessel, but any radar on any ship would be able to detect the cargo ship, especially on a high-tech Navy vessel like the USS Fitzgerald. So, What happened? Now, obviously, there's a lot of personnel on the U.S. Navy vessel. The captain was asleep at the time. This is what they're telling us. And they just didn't see it on radar. Or they turned off their radar.
But the Navy is calling this one of the worst at-sea disasters in decades.
These kind of collisions with Navy vessels are so rare. It happens like once or twice every like three or four decades because the radar and communication technology they have on these ships is impeccable. This is not supposed to happen unless they allow what happened. allow it to happen. Now, also with a collision like this, you would think on the cargo ship, there were about 20 people on the cargo ship, that somebody would have been injured, right? With this kind of collision against this huge Navy ship, but nothing, nothing, nothing. And the damage on the cargo ship is like nothing. And this Navy vessel received major damage. Now, it would take a lot of force to create the kind of destruction to that ship that you see. You don't just have destruction on the deck. You have it at the bottom, the huge gas that almost sunk the ship. This is major damage, major damage. And given the fact that we're in an area where we have lots of enemies and they're not telling us something, we need to know who was on that cargo ship besides their race. What was on that cargo ship and what was its destination? We need to know that. Second, we need to know the cargo ship and the personnel on this ship waited almost an hour to contact Japanese authorities or anybody regarding the collision. What did you think if you ran in, right, to a U.S. Navy vessel, you'll call somebody right away? There's red flags all over this. This could be something that is going to lead into something bigger, given the fact that false flags usually are a little hesitant.
All right, so you get the picture from that. We'll take a break here, and we'll come back with Ben Rawson and Steve Wilmoth. 523-1450 at 713 AM, Las Cruces AM 1450. You're listening to KOBE. Well, we're here and we've got Ben Rawson and a guest, Steve Wilmoth, who has not been on the show for a while. But welcome, gentlemen. And we are going to be talking about land today.
Land. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning, Kelly.
On Tuesday's County Commission agenda, I have a resolution that I've placed on the agenda dealing with Secretary Zinke's review of the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument. And what the request is as he's doing that review, to make sure he considers the private lands that are within the monument footprint, as well as the state lands that are in there. And, you know, Kelly, we've got an interesting opportunity here with this review. And when the original footprint was drawn, it included a lot of private lands. And so that's a taking from those private individuals on not being able to use the lands that they already have within the area. And so since there's going to be a review anyway, I'd like to make sure that those things are considered and be able to have some discussion on that. And the same thing on the state lands, Kelly. The revenue from the state lands goes to our public school students, and the schools need that money now more than ever, you know, with everything that's been going on with budget cuts and whatnot. So the importance of protecting those assets that we have as a county, at the same time protecting the Oregon Mountains. And I'm not aware of anyone that wants to not protect the Oregon Mountains. They're one of the biggest reasons that people move here. They're just beautiful. So we definitely want to keep those protected. And then the question is, and that I'm bringing up is, in this review, let's go ahead and look at those.
So go ahead.
So, Kelly, when we start looking at the Doñana County, the entire county, there's only 9.6% of it that is not federal or that is not government land. And so when you consider that less than one out of every 10 acres actually is contributing to our local economy, we need to be careful in losing the rest of that.
According to many people on the left, that's an answer, not a problem, that the federal government or the state would own the land where you're at is an answer, because fill in the blank.
Well, you know, Kelly, if you were a socialist, that would make perfect sense. As you know, and your listeners know, I'm a strong capitalist. So I think it's important for us to have the opportunity to do something with our land to make our area better.
What's
and
at stake?
Not rely on the federal government.
What's at stake on land ownership, federal or state versus private? Steve?
Well, let's start with the fact
and
that...
Steve, would you introduce yourself a little bit in terms of your ranching history, your family, the Butterfield Trail?
I am a rancher from Doñana County. I actually spill over into Luna County. But the historical note is that at least one of my great grandparents watered cattle at our headquarters now on the Butterfield Trail Ranch, the old Lazy E, in 1884. We've been there, or we've been a part of the land for a long time. We did not own this ranch until the turn of the century, but it served as the cow trail, as the highway for pioneers into our area for 150 years.
What was that first guy, the first person that, you know, from your family that was working there? What was that person's name?
Well, Lee Rice certainly watered cattle in 1884. Or Peter Shelley in 1884. Lee Rice came in 1888. But, and both have family remaining on the land, both in Grant County and now here in Doniana County since. We have a strong stewardship ethic, and we feel that our presence on this land, like the original discussion, Kelly, deja vu, now running 10 years, that we need some consideration for our presence on the land. To get to your question, 7.5% of the footprint of the monument is privately held. So many of the objects for protection are on private land or on state land. The proclamation itself states that those lands are reserved until which time they are controlled or owned by the federal government. My comment to Commissioner Rawson is that there is a fiduciary responsibility that we need to look at. We cannot lose that tax base when we have less than 1 acre in 10 owned privately in this county.
All right. Let me ask you guys before we get any deeper into this. This is a poor county. Does the federal government coming in and owning most of the land here, does it make us wealthy or poor?
Kelly, it certainly makes us poorer on that regard. You know, there used to be some money that the federal government would pay in the form of PILT, payment in lieu of taxes. And so the federal government would pay that based on the acreage they own to try and help make up for that. That money has continued to be shrunk year after year to where even though the federal government is getting more and more land out of Doniana County, the payments continue to shrink. At one point, we were getting close to $9 million a year. Now we're getting less than $4 million a year.
All right. So there was a claim when the left and they had bussed all these people into these town halls, all these local people from Iowa or from Wisconsin, wherever they brought them in from, so that the actual local people couldn't get into the seats. There was a claim that this would turn the national monument status or whatever the title is, that status would bring us an enormous number of visitors. Has that panned out?
Kelly, I'm not aware of any studies that show that that's panned out. You certainly have people saying, oh, yeah, look how many more people are here. I'm seeing more license plates, that kind of thing. But I don't know of any studies one way or another that show the economic impact that has taken
place.
Let's
put it this way. It doesn't seem like there is an influx of visitors to me, and I'm out on the streets every day.
Right.
There, if you listen to the city council discussion on Monday when they passed their resolution, they talked about the boon that the monument has brought to Doniana County.
Not the boondoggle?
They talked about the increase in gross receipts tax, but I'll bet you that we could map the same thing in TRC or Silver City, Albuquerque, Bernalillo, and there are a growing number who believe that that is simply a function of the fuel prices that have existed and the ability for folks to travel.
Steve, let me jump in on that, because when we start talking about gross receipts tax revenue, the state gives us a breakdown of where what industry that revenue is coming from. And the biggest increase that we're seeing in the city of Las Cruces, because, of course, that's within Doniana County as well, is we're seeing a 25% increase in construction GRT. So the big driver of the GRT increases that both the city and the county are receiving is from construction and does not have anything to do with the monument.
And the less land we have, the less construction we can do.
That's true. But, you know, Kelly, when we talk about the monument and talk about the Oregon Mountains, what I'm suggesting would not take the Oregon Mountains and put them into construction land. I mean, that's still protected land, I think, that needs to stay protected
land. Steve Pierce had a plan that was 50,000 acres approximately instead of 600,000. And a lot of people will be shocked to find out that part of this land here, pardon me, is in a hatch.
Well, it is in the Las Uvas, the greater footprint of the Las Uvas. You know, if you looked at the Potrillo segment alone, it's the largest national monument in New Mexico, and the Las Uvas is greater. Ben is absolutely right. And again, the demand for fiduciary responsibility to clarify the status of these private lands going forward. Everything else aside, the matter of national defense, border security, the easements that are vital. When Burlington Northern is running 50 unit trains a day up through the city, there will be impact. We've lost the ability to skirt the outside of the city in a right of way.
How does that work?
The most logical right of way to skirt railroad traffic around the town is the West Mesa, up through the Corralitos, down through Faulkner Canyon, and join the existing track going up through the Jornada. That is gone because of the National Monument. So we're either going to have 50 unit trains a day going up through the valley, or we're going to lose that to Texas, where existing north-south routes exist today.
And this would impact Santa Teresa.
This would impact Santa Teresa. When Ferromexico, when they finish their spur into the United States, crossing at Annapolis, Santa Teresa, we will see an astounding increase in traffic. We need that ability to skirt around Las Cruces, or it's going to become a railroad town with 50 to 70 unit trains a day running right up through
the
business center.
That kind of makes you wonder how long there would be of a wait if that was all put together at these train stops.
Well, look at the liability. The liability on their part, the risk to human safety on our part, and the loss of the revenue that is associated with that traffic through Santa Teresa. It's a debacle. But the point becomes, all that is mute. All that is mute in the city council resolution. That is mute if our congressmen can't prevail on the administration on those kinds of subjects. At least we have to look at the fiduciary responsibilities of those private lands, 7.5% of that footprint, Kelly. And we need to look at the disposition into the future. Your comment about 500, what did you say? 500,000?
That the...
It was correct.
Steve Pierce wanted to, that it would...
That's 58,000.
It was. All right. So,
okay.
It would have protected everything that we consider to be the organs.
And what's ironic about that is that the Antiquity Act, used as the mechanism to do this, applies only to historical and scientific issues. Viewscape, iconic landscape, does not have anything to do in the Antiquities Act. But the point, I want to make this point, is that when you add the private land, the state land in, we're at 575,000 acres of footprint. And if anybody says that that isn't the National Monument, they're fooling themselves.
But, I mean... For the most part, this was, I mean, these people wanted to do it. They acted like they were selling their soul to Satan for a handful of magic beans. I mean, they were just jumping off the cliff like lemmings, and they couldn't wait to do it. And they're as if there could be no downside to getting rid of the organs.
If you had been in attendance at the city council meeting, you would have seen that pep rally, that group of white affluent citizens politicking, pushing this resolution for this sport.
Also known as cucks in the far right language. So anyway, we'll take a break right here. Kelly O'Connell, and we've got Steve Wilmoth, and it is the Rossin Report, and it's exciting stuff, folks. It's going to affect your future. Feel free to get up and call in, but get involved in this fight, because the far left has driven this county into a gully a long time ago, and we're suffering the whole time. There is no economic viability in this city. We'll be right back. All right, we're talking about the Oregon Mountains, this debacle of a boondoggle, and what the bad part of it. So, guys, keep going. Steve?
Well, I left out something extremely important. In the original discussion and the original objectivity set forth against the grand scheme of the footprint, and that was flood control. We have to add that in, and that's not just source of water. That is life and human safety. We're forced to live in this valley, and ultimately, what that entails is the attrition of our irrigated farm base. Can't grow out of the valley. We're going to see that demise. And one of the great things that make this place unique is that agricultural universe. And that worries me to no end.
Well, it is a disaster to turn the government into a god, and to cede all power to the government and say they will take care of us because that's their duty. How does the government know all of the millions of parts? Here's the argument for one of the arguments for conservatism is one group of people, no matter how brilliant, cannot make the right decisions for hundreds of millions of individuals. They can't, and they shouldn't be able to. Each person has their own responsibility, the best out of their life. And in some ways, in some instances, it would be a farmer advocating or building, trying to get water to his crops. That's something the government's never going to be able to do as efficiently as the private market.
Nothing happens beyond the grassroots that ultimately reflects the relative advantage of the area. We have to have that ability to act and develop the resources here and
protect
the resources.
And it's the genius of capitalism and the free market to allow individual people. Think of all of the billions of patents that have been awarded inventions that people have come up with on their own to solve a particular problem. Even the greatest group of thinkers in history assembled to run a great nation is not going to be able to do that. That's why you have to give power to the people.
Every ranch in our community, every farm in our community is unique. It is a system unto itself. The infrastructure is created on the basis of what has happened there and the influences of natural resources and terrain. If you take that away, if you pass that land planning on to somebody else, they're not going to understand that, and all is lost.
They're not going to care. They're going to make the government makes decisions not with a little, a little paintbrush that you do a portrait with. They use a roller. You're never going to get the details right for the leadership of a people.
Well, and Kelly, talking about that and looking at the last land use situation that the county dealt with, which was the Unified Development Code. And now staff is bringing up 18 different amendments that staff is proposing that need to be made to that Unified Development Code because they're seeing some of those holes and problems that I was talking about during the debate. And so when you talk about government being able to do the right thing here, I don't have a lot of confidence in that. I think that the people who actually live here and participate in the land are going to have a better understanding of what needs to be done. You look at Hatch. Part of this footprint is in Hatch, as we've discussed. You remember the flooding that we had in 2006?
Devastating.
Flooding that we had.
Devastating.
And that sure didn't help anybody that lived up there. So.
I want to point out one thing, and this is to change subject just for one second, is this mad commitment to mass transit or to public transportation would be more appropriate. I found out why Billy Garrett is so attached to that when he gave his speech at the NAACP that I was at. He had stated that he had read somewhere the number one national problem in urban areas is transportation. So you get, and this is how government works. You get one theme that applies everywhere, and you don't care if it applies locally because you know it applies locally because it's part of your liberal indoctrination or part of your liberal blueprint. So kind of decision-making is destructive.
It is. And Kelly, the important word in there was urban, and here we are talking about Anthony and Chaparral and La Union, the areas that are not urban.
Well, I must have misspoke, but anyway, we got a phone call. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show.
Kelly, you're right about them. They pick up a theme that has national attention. I don't know if you saw that Monday city council meeting, but the mayor's on board. He just joined some coalition of mayors that are protesting Trump's, you know, Paris Accord.
Doesn't surprise me. I mean, so, you know, Steve Smith and what's Mr. Smith's first name, by the way?
Greg
Smith. I called him Steve Smith after the famous wide receiver. Yeah. But Greg Smith thinks that it's a better use of our time to draft statements to the president than it does to do local business. I think it's crazy.
Right. You know, Kelly, my concern is this, and I'll hang up. You know, I think someone I think they – my fear is that they want us all to install solar panels in our homes.
Right.
I don't want that. I don't need it. But I think that's where they're heading with that. Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
Your time, Kelly. Good work.
Thanks. All right, guys. So,
well, Kelly, I want to go off of that last call just for a brief second, because there's now an effort at the county commission level to allow you to install solar panels on your home and put that charge on your tax bill and make the treasurer for the county become the collector for loans that are made to outside individuals.
Sounds illegal.
And there's just a mess with that. So
what I meant was rural, of course. I said urban, but Billy Garrett got it in his head. He had read something. Billy Garrett might have an IQ of 200. Let's just presume that's true. Smartest guy in the county. His idea on transportation is a total disaster. It is a boondoggle. And that type of thinking applied to government is going to be coming out of the Oregon Mountain situation.
And Kelly, now they have a meeting next Tuesday evening to say we need a rail line. And so they're putting in
to where?
Between these other communities that aren't riding the buses. So they're not riding the buses. Let's put in a rail line. For sure they'll ride the rail line that gets put in there.
Why don't we take all these people and put them in a camp so that we can get them food and water? But here we have another call. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connell Show. Who is it?
Oh, hello, Kelly. This is Bill Rossengass. How do we get a copy of this Russen report? You guys are talking about the Oregon Mountain. I would like to get that to our homeowners association and play it at our next meeting.
Conversation today is on Blog Talk Radio. Kelly O'Connell, you can download it, and you're free to use it any way you want. In terms of the report from the, I guess I'm not sure exactly what you're looking for.
Mainly the portion, I just texted the commissioner to see the same thing. Mainly I'm talking about the portion that is regarding the monument.
Okay, Kelly, let me jump in real quick.
Hold on. Steve Wilmot.
And I don't want to be presumptuous, but I think he's referring to the Zinke review, which has been put out for comments, public comments, by July 10th. That is what we need to be looking at and aiming at for influence of a reassessment.
There's something that came out that I was just absolutely gobsmacked by. Cia Levitino said during the meeting that since nobody showed up from any of the farming concerns, that means that nothing bad happened. And I was astounded by that. I mean, why assume that?
Yeah, you can't. No, you can't.
We have another call. Thank you. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Yeah, this is Tom.
Yeah, Tom, what's up?
Yeah, I think we ought to put a ban on California refugees coming into Las Cruces.
Internment camp is the answer. Thanks, Tom. We need to get all these people who are living in these rural areas and put them in a camp to make sure they get food and water.
And Kelly, back to Bill Rothen.
We got to take a break here. We'll be right back. Weather. Talking about here. Touches on the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the 13th and 14th Amendment, all of the amendments, really, the right to own property and be able to defend your rights in court or from usurpers. Gentlemen. So anyway, that may be a segue into nothing, but I do think that we need to remember we're a constitutional republic. We came from somewhere. And we're headed somewhere. We need to defend our rights, and one of the most precious rights is property.
Absolutely. Yeah. And with that, and saddled with it, is the protection of that minority right. in the case of our discussion, you know, 90 families are affected directly whole county's affected, but 90 families are affected, and there is no way that we prevail against the group that attended the city council meeting on Monday. I think there were some 252. We're like the small states, and like the argument of the founders. How do we protect our minority rights?
You know, Kelly, I think as we look at this, I think there's a lot that people aren't considering about the monument. And when we talk about private lands that are in there, those are lands that people own and that people have rights to do things with that are being taken away. And it isn't just to protect the Oregon Mountains. There's a different process in place here to protect a lot more than that, or rather to take a lot more than that. You made the comment earlier about us giving away the Oregon Mountains, and that's exactly what is happening in this process. We're giving away the Oregon Mountains to the federal government and hoping that they do something with them. But I think we're a lot better off when we're protecting those, and they still need to be protected. Don't get me wrong. We need to protect the Oregon Mountains. They're pristine beauty for our area and something that people look to a lot. So they need to be protected, but the other areas outside of that where we have private lands, where we have state lands that go to support our school kids, it's very important that we protect the value on those lands.
And we have protections on those federal lands in place as well.
Right.
The process is very straightforward. If there is going to be liquidation of those lands, that goes through a scoping process and a land planning process. Those operations out there are predicated on open space. We don't want those lands developed. We don't want those lands sold on the basis of holding our ranching units together. We have existing protections in place already. So we're back to what should be a subject that all commissioners can support, and that is simply to review the status of those private and state lands that mean so much both for revenue sources for our schools, as well as those private property rights that allow us to exist there.
And those private properties create revenue for the county as well.
Absolutely, the tax base.
And, you know, that goes back to another thing we touched on earlier, which is that the entire acreage of Doñana County, there's only 9.6%, less than 10%, less than 1 out of 10 acres is actually private held land in our county. I don't think people realize how much of that land is already government land. And so we need to protect the tax base that's left, because the county still has to provide services even on those federal and state and other government lands.
People don't care because a lot of people feel disenfranchised. They're not business owners. They don't have any wealth. How a quarter of the people in this county under the poverty line, another quarter of this county just above the poverty line, and you've got a leadership that says and brags about this is a no-growth area. To me, that's like going to a leper colony and saying, you know what, we're not looking for a cure. We're just trying to make your lives a little more comfortable. It's sick.
And the decision-making bodies, it's almost become a spectator sport. And, Kelly, that's what I was trying to reach for a while ago, that there is nobody in that group or in those bodies that has faced this flood firsthand. You know, we just seek some consideration, and I think that it harkens back to this idea. We've got to look at the status of those private properties, and that's all we're asking. We're asking Commissioners Gonzalez, Solis, and Vasquez to join Commissioner Rawson to allow this to happen.
So how do people get a hold of you guys?
Kelly, and that was the thing I was going to mention about Bill Rothengast mentioned he had texted me. I have not received a text from him. Bill and anyone else listening, my cell phone number is 575-649-4153. You can reach me anytime on that number. That's the best way to get a hold of me, Kelly.
Okay, and Steve?
Best way, Kelly, is through you. I'm going to get you that information from Secretary Zinke regarding the public comments that can go on your website. And that's the most important thing that we can do today in this discussion. We want comments coming from folks that are impacted by this monument.
All right, we'll take a little break here. Thanks for coming on, guys.
Thank you.
All right, so 751, and just tending the embers of the conversation now. The show's pretty much over. I've read some interesting articles, and I'm trying to see if there would be one that I could kind of pass on to you. Nancy Pelosi, that we started the show with, she's losing power. Cher no longer backs her because they're using Pelosi across the United States to discredit the party. Nancy Pelosi is worse to Democrats than Reagan or Trump is to Republicans. We have a call. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connell's show. Who's this?
Hi, it's JR. How you doing, Kelly?
Good, JR. What's up?
I overheard you say that Mayor Chen pledged for the Paris Accord.
He did what?
He said that he'd throw the city of Las Cruces into the Paris Accord.
No, I don't. Somebody said something about him signing up the city for he joined some group of mayors that are against the accord, I guess. Now Mayor Miyagashima signed us up for ICLEA, which is Agenda 21, which is a whole nother kettle of fish, but it's the same idea, no growth, get people off the land, get people, farmers off the land and such, and get them to move into the city to cut down on the amount of, gasoline and power and water and everything. So
right. Yeah, and, I'm familiar with that. So, I was just wondering if he knows that joining something like that, the city of Las Cruces has to put money into that.
Well, here's,
I just don't understand that.
Here is the problem to me. Did Mayor Miyagashima get up in any forum or put through in any referendum? Do you want the city to join this? Because when you deal with elitists, when you deal with people that believe that they're on the upper echelon and they're leaders, and like he came on the show and said he was a statesman, you think that you're herding a bunch of dumb people like cattle into these cattle cars to save them. And that's the attitude here. It's terrible. I mean, it's that kind of leadership is a death sentence, in terms of growth and such. So anyway, JR, we're running out of time. Anything else?
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you. Well, folks, we got to find out what this next thing that he signed us up for. But, the fact of the matter is everybody I've ever heard talk about the mayor says that he's condescending. What that's about exactly, you can speculate. But obviously it would be quite possible to interpret that as that he has a lot of contempt for the average person. And he's here. He's got a duty. He may not enjoy the duty, but he's got a duty of leadership, and in part, he's working to save the world. Now, that might sound like something out of a cartoon, and it might be a ridiculous, in the real world and how this stuff actually plays out, it might be a ridiculous journey that he's on, but we're all being affected by it. And, I don't think he and Billy Garrett and some of these other far-left leaders are going to change their tune, so we need to change our leadership, Why can't we find somebody who's actually interested in having an economy here so people can have jobs and we can grow? Here's another call. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connell's show. Who's this?
This is Robin Tillett. I had attended a meeting on Monday.
Okay. What was it like?
Well, most people there were in favor of the monument. They are very much uninformed. There was one former retired BLM agent who attended, who was opposed to it on the grounds of constitutionality and the fact that the BLM is already protecting those various sites. The Antiquities Act was passed under Teddy Roosevelt. My problem with it is that, is it really constitutional? Because it allows the president to confiscate property under the federal government by proclamation.
Right.
It never goes before Congress.
Right.
Additionally, under the Constitution, the federal government is not allowed to own land except for courts, military installations, public buildings like courthouses and post offices. They're not allowed to own public land.
Well, they have a great deal of public land in the West, so I don't know.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But see, when the states became when the territories in the West became states, they were the federal government or Congress was required to give them back all of their lands. Because by that time, Woodrow Wilson was in power. He's progressive. They don't believe in private property, and so they never gave the states their land. That was unconstitutional to begin with.
Yes.
And then they maintain it. So I'm as to what the constitutionality of the Antiquities Act is to begin with. Even though they're using it, the city council was demanding that we continue to use it. And I'm not quite sure they even should be using that act. It should be probably repealed.
I'm sure that what you're saying is absolutely true. And I appreciate the call. And I mean, they're misusing the Antiquities Act. We'll have to get it where I'm running out of time. But thanks for the call, Robin.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. All right, folks. Here's a little bit on summer vacations from Jim Gaffigan.
Last winter, I think we all still have emotional scars. Well, summer is finally here to wash away all those horrible memories. Can you believe it? Summer, the golden boy of seasons. Everyone loves summer. What's not to love? Sunny days, warm weather, and don't forget, it's not winter. Now, it may not come as a huge surprise to you that I don't hop on the summer bandwagon. I am pale and nobody wants to see me in shorts. Like most pudgy guys, I prefer light jacket weather. I like a place to put my keys and hide the fact I haven't worked out in 2 decades. I'm sure most of you love summer. It's like a 3-month vacation. Of course, this isn't true. But the perception of a summer holiday sure makes doing work during the summer feel like punishment. Summer does mean no school for my children. Hey, who doesn't deserve a 3-month break after a rigorous year of kindergarten? I don't know exactly what's good about my kids getting the summer off. My kids lounge around the apartment like they've returned from fighting ISIS with a constant, "What are we going to do now?" look on their faces. I already can't wait for the back-to-school commercials. Entertaining children is not the only summer pressure. The warm summer weather means pressure to do things outside. This is why I don't live in Southern California. Nice weather is like an assignment. Don't waste a day. Go lie on the beach and get skin cancer. I'm sure many of you think I'm being negative about your sacred summer. I'm just pale, pudgy, and lazy. But soon, you'll come over to my side. I see it every August. That's when we all start regretting the horrible things we said about winter. It's when we go from appreciating our air conditioner to treating it like our most prized employee. You okay there, air conditioner? I know you've been working hard lately, but tell you what, after Labor Day, it's all downhill. You're guaranteed a 7-month vacation. Please don't quit. Enjoy your summer, everyone.
All right, folks, we'll take you out with some James Booker. Have a great day. See you back in 22 hours. Ciao.